Hey, this is Laura.
And Steven.
And this is our podcast, Midday Musings, where we take our lunch break to talk about the things that are on our mind. Today, we're discussing episode 4 of HBO Max's The Regime, starring Kate Winslet. It's called Midnight Feast. It is a battle of political alignments. We are dealing with the aftermath of Chancellor Elena's global isolation following the Fabian Corridor operation, and a little bit of 1984 for your snoot. Let's get into it. Hello, friend.
Hello, amiga.
How are you, Steven?
You know, I'm doing fantastic.
Good.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted.
That's right. I wanted it too.
Then I'm glad that you have it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I feel good. How about you? What's going on?
I feel pretty great. Life is good. There's a cat beside me.
Ooh.
She might attack. We'll see.
Well, as long as you don't pet her when she's looking at the other cat, I think you're going to be okay. But you can never tell when she's going to do that. So good luck.
The danger is part of the appeal.
Ooh, you know what? I get that. That actually kind of reminds me of The Regime, to be honest.
Yes. Much like Zubak of The Regime, the physical danger
is part of his appeal.
It's part of the attraction to whatever this is.
And that's right, folks. We're back to talk about The Regime again. Episode 4.
Yes, Midnight Feast, starring Kate Winslet, of course, always, but additionally Hugh Grant.
I know, right? What? Good old Hugh Grant.
Yeah, here he is, being a political prisoner, a former politician who has been imprisoned by Elena for many, many years.
Yeah, he's such a fun character because clearly he's in jail. He's been in prison for a long, long time, but he also has a lot of sway over the jailers, like they can bring him stuff. And they have like a dinner together sometimes and you're like, he's a prisoner, but because he's like a chancellor or a former chancellor, he's still got a decent amount of power in that prison.
Oh yeah. And he's been there for like a number of years.
Yeah.
It's suggested by the show that he's been in prison basically since Elena ascended to power,
but she's
utilizing her state media as propaganda. So she actually has this character, Kiplinger, former chancellor, centrist leftist. He'll be trotted out to a manor sometimes to film propaganda pieces,
yeah,
suggesting
which is so
fun. Suggesting that he's still her political adversary somewhere out in the countryside, still a danger. And so she's pulling like a 1984 Goldstein sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, oh, you know, the radical Kiplinger wants to destroy us and our way of life and my regime.
Yes, radical left Kiplinger. He's terrible and he's out in his country manor plotting to destroy us every single day. But no, she actually has him imprisoned in a cell and she trots him out to do propaganda films so that she has an adversary. And it's beautiful. It's something.
Yeah, it is. It is statescraft 101.
Yeah, dude. And I love that you mentioned 1984 because she does do a strong 1984 in this. Like, she's got the radio going at specific hours of the day. There'll be radio announcements from the chancellor where she's talking about a lot about love and how love conquers all and how she loves everyone in her country. Yeah, she said there'll be no guerrillas, only renewal of our love. U.S. sanctions are a no-go. Our love cannot be sanctioned.
Oh, yeah. She's doing a patter about the post-Fabian Corridor occupation,
yeah.
right? So she's like, what you've heard is wrong. There are no rebels. There are no guerrillas. It was a peaceful transition of power. The only enemy in our midst is Kiplinger.
Yes.
Somewhere in the countryside in his manor house plotting our ruin. No, he is in fact in a nice little concrete cell. Well decorated as far as cells go, but definitely, definitely in prison.
Oh yeah, not doing well. And you find this out in a very interesting way because the beginning of this episode starts with Corporal Zubak, who has fallen to the lowest of lows. He is now in prison, sleeping on his cot, kind of an isolated confinement. He's got the radio going every hour and it's driving him crazy because it is the chancellor's voice and he is still obsessed with her, but also is incredibly mad about being put in prison by her. So he's not able to sleep. So
oh,
you just see him
yeah,
slowly going
is,
crazy in
no,
the cell.
It's 4 months since episode 3 and Zubak has been in prison presumably that entire time. They have, by regulation, the radio going in everyone's cells 24/7.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's some pretty classic pseudo-torture, political prisoner, nightmare regime stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
because Kiplinger and Zubak are sort of sharing space in this sort of intimate prison that we find out is linked to the palace. We watch Elena walk through her palace through a bunch of statuary and like concrete corridors and ultimately down into the prison that contains Kiplinger and Zubak. So Zubak is having the worst time.
He's just having a terrible time.
But Kiplinger spots him, knows who he is, because as mentioned in the first episode, Zubak is a butcher from a significant event at a cobalt mine. A laborer strike turned violent. He's famous too. Yeah. People know who he is.
And everyone, now that he's in this cell, that Zubak is in the cell, is calling him butcher again, which he hates.
Yeah, he has a real big problem with it. I think the moment that he fell in love with the Chancellor was when she said, "But you're not a butcher, you're a man who needs love."
Yeah.
And it was clear that that was the first nice thing anyone had ever said to him.
Right, at least since the incident in the cobalt mines happened. And the fun thing about it is that's what she uses to humanize him and get him as her ally. But then, as you see in episode 3, she like dehumanizes him again because she starts calling him an ox. And that's when he loses it, says, I am not an ox. And she goes, "No, you're not. You're a butcher." And then he just... He can't. He can't anymore.
Yeah, Elena's love is hot and cold like wild.
Oh, yeah.
Like mad.
So she's called him a butcher. Now everyone in the prison is calling him a butcher again. But notable about Hugh Grant as Ed Kiplinger, he asks for Zubak to be brought to him so they can talk. He's clearly trying to strike an alliance with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he insists that the guards not call him butcher. Say, call Zubak by his actual name, or you won't be allowed to have the sausage that we have served at our
prison table. Yeah, the midnight feast that this episode is titled is their little meeting spot with Kiplinger and the guards. They have a little feast that happens sometimes late at night where they share some sausage and some cheese and some alcohol, and it's very comradely.
It's freaking delightful, and I love how he leans over to Zubak and says, "But don't tell anyone, it's our little secret. Shh." Like, they just have this little midnight feast. And so Kiplinger is just reeling in Zubak over the course of this episode, just really trying to get him to be his ally.
Yeah, just trying to charm mm-hmm. him. Because Zubak has a lot of political capital. He Not really only does. Is he part of the cobalt mine, labor strike, butchery, he also was the general of the successful Fabian Corridor operation.
Yeah. So Zubak, at the end of episode 3, he is the general who conquers the Fabian Corridor, and then he attacks the Chancellor, and he has dirt on her about her holding company and her misuse of funds, and then he basically beats a billionaire to death. If he was smart and had exited palace in that moment, he could have gone into the field and been like a folk hero. He could have been the face of the resistance.
Yeah, but he has the common touch.
Yeah, he does. And you see that. Oh my gosh, you see that because he's there in this feast. In the previous episode where it's him and Elena, and he's invited commoners to come and sit, and she talks to them, her words have no effect. But then he uses that phrase that he loves to use, which is build it as high as you can, but build it from our earth. And they love it. They get on their feet. They're applauding for him. So it's clear he has the common people touch. So Kiplinger is kind of digging into that, reeling him in. And Kiplinger has kind of I think the director said he has a kind of a Blair or Obama quality.
No, it was Hugh Grant who specifically said he had a Tony Blair Obama political alignment. And what that means is pure centrist.
Yeah.
So as you remember, Tony Blair worked quite closely with George W. Bush, and also worked quite closely with Obama. And Obama, despite what people think about him politically, was like a straight up centrist mm-hmm. in terms of political alignment. So that's what Kiplinger is bringing. It's a professional statesman quality, like a sort of true neutral, I'll do a deal with you, middle of the road political quality.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting because Zubak definitely represents a far left populism. And Elena represents more of a right wing populism.
Oh, for sure.
If you're into political alignment, that's a fun interplay.
Yeah, and by the end of episode 3, she kind of represents right-wing fascism in a way.
I mean, if you go far enough right.
Right. And it's just fun to see the three of them playing against each other. I love the moments when Kiplinger is trying to reel in Zubak, and Zubak says, "You know, since I've met you, I don't dream anymore. And dreams are a very big part of his connection with Elena, with the Chancellor. Mm-hmm. They're the reason why he loves her and why he follows her. And he tells Keplinger, like, I can't follow you unless I love you. I want to love you, but I don't. And you can kind of see Keplinger is losing Zubek a bit. But they have some fun conversations. Elena comes and visits Keplinger. They have some fantastic dialogue of, like, the current chancellor who has jailed the former chancellor, and they hash it out. And it's also fun seeing them because Hugh Grant and Kate Winslet, I believe, were in Sense and Sensibility like a million years ago.
Yeah, in 1995.
Yeah, in 1995 when she was just baby Kate Winslet.
Yeah, Alan Rickman was there. Yeah. Emma Thompson was there. It's a great movie. You should watch it.
Right? And so you see her, you see Kate Winslet in these director's commentary talking about Hugh Grant in a way where he's just so above her, as if she still sees him like she was the baby just starting in Hollywood in 1995 in Sense and Sensibility, and as if she's not this fantastic luminary of our time. Like, she's made it. She's as big as, if not bigger than Hugh Grant, but she still sees him as like this monumental figure because, you know, they worked together when she was very young.
Well, yeah, and Hugh Grant in the 90s was a whole thing.
Oh my gosh, he was. Really was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would argue that no one in current Hollywood is as famous as anyone in the 1990s was.
Yeah.
Like the Julia Roberts, George Clooney, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hugh Grant,
Brad Pitt,
era, Meg Ryan, mm-hmm. Tom Hanks.
George Clooney.
Yes, I said George Clooney.
Oh, you did. George Clooney twice.
Yeah, like it was a level of fame that we can't conceive of now because the world was so much smaller.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have a very interesting setup here. Because we have in episode 3, Zubak being pushed away from Elena. Mm-hmm. And now in episode 4, it's sort of like a come to Jesus moment for him where he's offered a political alternative. He could betray her. Actually, a lot of people could betray her in this in this episode. Her head of household is getting texts from potentially an American operative saying, maybe. We can help you. We can help your son. And the showrunner said that this was taken from the Syrian civil war, where it was a really treacherous time when you got these text messages, maybe from the outside world saying we could help you, but maybe from your paranoid government who's trying to weed out spies or weed out the disloyal. So everyone's like loyalty tested in this.
Yeah.
Zubak is being loyalty tested by sort of Kiplinger's attempts to bring him closer through the midnight feasts. And he also gives him his book on democracy, but it's very heady intellectual stuff. That's what we're saying about Kiplinger, Hugh Grant's Kiplinger being a Tony Blair Obama type. These are highly educated men for whom liberalism is an academic proposition. They're very classic educated liberals, which is different than being a populist leftist.
Absolutely.
Which is what Zubak represents. So they're trying to court this more rural of the people ideological stand-in, and like Kiplinger does not succeed. Mm-mm. Precisely because of the conversation that you alluded to earlier, where Zubak says, but I don't love you. And Kiplinger, he's like, that's the problem with you people. You don't want to help yourself. You just want to live in your feelings. A love? Who cares? And I think that does represent the annoyance of the common people towards the sort of like Obama liberalism. It feels intellectual. It feels a little bit superior. Mm. It's hard to connect to if you're not intellectual. People do want to live in their feelings.
Yeah.
They do want to love their leader. But that idea, that sort of really traditional folk concept of loving one's leader, it's at odds with modern democracy, which is so academic in so much of what it does. It's so tangled and bureaucratic. It's a complex machine. Mm. And a person who isn't trained in the complexity of that machine can't connect to it, not emotionally.
Mm, that's fair. There's a lot of back reading you have to do to get caught up on that. And also an interest in it. As you mentioned, like Keplinger gives him his book. He claims almost as a joke, like, oh, he asks him, by the way, you haven't read it, have you? And Zubak's like, no, I haven't. And he goes, oh, good, good. Of course not. It's terrible. Please don't do it. As if to like goad him on to read it. But he continues to not read that book.
Yeah.
And you can tell he probably, Zubak isn't really a man who prioritizes reading. It's not his thing, you know?
No, he's visceral.
Yeah. The fun thing about Keplinger and the Chancellor, Chancellor Elena, is that they're actually very similar in that they are both very well educated. They're very much in their ideas and their ideals and
such. Do you think so?
I think so.
I disagree completely.
Well, she talks about dreams and how dreams motivate her and that sort of thing. And he talks about having ideals and writes books. I feel like they're more similar than she and Zubak are in that way.
I mean, she's more similar to Kiplinger than Zubak is to Kiplinger, mm-hmm. but she 100% has nothing. She is not an intellectual. Like, she may be trained as a physician, but intellectualism, it has to do with like the humanities, mm-hmm. which is totally separate from the sciences. So she is talking to him in this wonderful scene, he'll attack her from an ideological standpoint, from an intellectual standpoint, and she'll come back with sort of brute, lower base arguments like, no one ever loved you, but you weren't powerful enough. You couldn't do it. And dreams aren't intellectual at all. They're feelings oriented. That's why I think she and Zubak connect so much, because they both don't live in an intellectual space. They live in an emotional space.
You know, that's an interesting point, because now that you mention it, the argument that Elena and Zubak have in episode 3 is actually very much emotional from both sides. They're throwing emotional hurts left and right, slings and arrows of emotion all the way. But yeah, I guess Kiplinger is a bit more of an intellectual thoughty guy.
A Woodrow Wilson-y sort of fellow.
A Woodrow Wilson-y sort of fellow. What do you mean by Woodrow Wilson?
Woodrow Wilson is our most educated president.
Oh, really?
And he is like the poster child for classic 20th century liberalism.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. He's big intellectual liberal, and people didn't like it.
Yeah, she is a bit more forceful, isn't she?
Yeah, she rules from the heart. She rules the way that, the way that objects of the cult of personality do, which is feel for me. Mm-hmm. Look at how I seem. Propaganda, elevation. Like, if there is a philosophy, it's a philosophy of emotions around her as your leader.
That's a good point. And actually, Keplinger points that out. At a certain point, he says, you know, talking about Elena and her people, she says they're born in pain. And so you turn their pain into anger and you use it as a cudgel. Brilliant. And she does.
And now they're using the cudgel against you.
And now, is that what he's, I missed that part. Yeah. Now they're using it back against her. So she made them into a weapon, but then the weapon turned back against her.
Yeah. And we're not even getting into the meat of this episode, that 4 months from the Fabian Corridor occupation, she is forced into a free trade agreement with China, because China is your alternative to America if you are isolated from them. But free trade with China is putting a bunch of cheap sugar onto the shelves of this country. And that sucks for them, because they are sugar beet producers. And so sugar beets being the national industry, there are a bunch of factories closing down, and that's causing a lot of unrest because the economy is taking a hit. And this leads to a specific protest in which a horse kicks a pregnant woman. Both the woman and the baby-to-be perish. And this becomes a rallying cry for her people. And she is directed to go out amongst her people to recover some political capital. She goes to the sugar beet union and speaks to the head of the union. And that is positive on the face of it. But after that experience, she's like, hey, head of security, I'm not saying anything, but like, enemies in the union office. And he's like, so you're not saying anything, but am I to understand that you would like us to find evidence of a conspiracy in the sugar beet union?
Oh, snap.
And she's like, your words, not mine. And he's like, so we might find guns and weapons. And she's like, your words, not mine. So at the end of this, the sugar beet union, who is the organizing locus around the protests in response to the economic catastrophe produced by her being isolated from the Western world, now it's maybe a civil war, because she takes out the head of that union, which only enrages her people more.
Yeah.
And she is staring down the barrel of a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And she loves it.
Oh, she's so ready for it.
And it culminates in her reunion with Zubek.
Yeah. And it's worth noting the horse that kicks and kills a woman by accident. It's a police horse. So obviously it's not just a random horse. That's why it incited such violence, because mm-hmm. there was a protest against what Chancellor Elena was doing. A police horse kills a woman and child. So it's like, oh, the police killed a woman and child.
Yeah, a representative of the state.
A representative of the state, right? So then that's really the powder keg that kind of started things. But when she betrayed the Sugar Beet Union like that, after showing up and making a good show.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everyone knew she probably had something to do with it, right? Like, it's from the inside, it's pretty clear that, like,
I feel if you live in her country, you know a little bit about how things work.
Right? Like, she was there last week, and then something really bad happened the next week. Oh, it's probably the Chancellor. Gosh darn it. Now it's time to revolt. I think on the news screen, it said, protesters demand total destruction.
Oh, yeah. So the propaganda, the news channel, which is her main line of propaganda, is spinning it so the Sugar Beet Union was in cahoots with Americans in a conspiracy to overthrow her government, and that's why they were targeted and arrested.
Yeah.
And then the news source also tells you that these protesters are demanding total destruction to demonize them.
Yeah.
So it's trying to create the good versus evil dichotomy that I think she works best in.
Oh, she loves it.
Yeah. It's her against the forces of Western imperialism and evil. And this is what a civil war starts to look like.
Well, she wanted to do something big and be remembered in history, and she probably will be.
The mantle of history.
Yeah, she wanted to wear the mantle of history. And I mean, if you can't be remembered for good stuff, you will be remembered for war. So there she goes. Oh boy. But no, I love how this episode ends, because Zubek has been just at the lowest of lows throughout this entire episode. And by the end, he's back in. Nikki and everyone else is kind of at a lower, they seem to be in a lower state at that point, like her advisors. It's just Elena and Zubek, and they are about to go to war.
Yeah, and this is exactly what they both want emotionally. Mm. Neither of them are interested in the practicalities of what their actions are doing. They're just fully in their heart space.
No, I don't think they have political alignments or like dreams for the people or desires for the people. I think they just desire power. I don't know what
they desire. Yeah, and their relationship, that echoes out into the wider world. So it's going to be fun, guys.
It's going to be real fun.
That's episode 4.
Yep. Man, it was quite a roller coaster ride. I hope not too many spoilers in this one. Left out some key details.
It's spoiler heavy.
This is spoiler heavy.
We're here for analysis, not to wet your whistle.
Right. You'll wet your whistle by watching the episode. But yeah, let us know what you thought. And we'll probably catch the next one, episode 5, and see what happens with Chancellor Elena and Corporal Zubek and whoever else they wrangle into their crazy circus of terror. We'll see what happens.
Yes. Thank you for spending your lunch break with us.
All right. Catch y'all next time.
Bye.
Bye. This has been Steven.
And Laura.
Thanks for tuning into Midday Musings, the podcast where we talk about all the things on our mind. Be sure to follow us on Spotify and jump into the conversation in our polls and Q&As. We would love to hear from you. Catch you next lunch break.